Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Welcome to Tech Lounge with me, Christian Chiller. I am on the road and didn't bring a microphone with me because I kind of forgot that I might need it for things like this. So I am going to be very, very quick and save you from this poor audio quality. Just to introduce this quite fascinating interview I had with Evelina from Final Spark a few months ago. And we talk about how they are making a bio computer. With that, I will get out of the way and let you enjoy the interview.
One of my most popular videos is an old one now on Mermaid, the markup language that lets you create diagrams, flowcharts, and all sorts of other things using a markup language. So you can mix it with Markdown, LaTeX, ASCII doc, etc., etc. It's used in a lot of static sites and documentation, and a lot of people like it because you can basically version images. Mermaid is open source and free, but some of the maintainers behind it have now created a new company called Mermaid Chart that turns Mermaid into a commercial enterprise tool with team features, more visual interface, AI diagrams, infinite canvas, whiteboard, all sorts of other cool features. Now, if you're interested in finding out more, I have a link you can follow to get a discount off a paid plan. And of course, earn a little bit for the show. Head on over to go.christianchiller.com/mermaid chart. Okay, Evelina, you made an interesting pitch on biocomputing. Now, I do remember a couple of years ago seeing people proposing things like DNA storage, but I'm not 100% sure where Final Spark fits into this whole aspect of leveraging organic matter and computing. So maybe give us a little bit of a quick summary of where Final Spark fits into that.
So Final Spark is totally different field than DNA storage. I have to say, to the best of my knowledge, DNA storage is still active idea. Mm. And there is active research in that, but it's totally different.
Yeah.
So what we have in common, also with quantum computing or any kind of DNA storage, whatever, is that this is unconventional computing.
Yeah.
So this is new way of computing, which is different than digital, what we are using today in our computers. And biocomputers, however, are totally different than other technologies, because actually every unconventional computing technology is different, because that's the whole idea, that you want to figure out something new. But what is the objective here? To find something, some new substrate for computation in unconventional computing. So some alternative to silicon. And we decided to use living neurons because living neurons are 1 million times more energy efficient as compared to the silicon. And we want to solve the problem of increasing energy consumption by artificial intelligence by building this technology.
I feel like we should get into a bit more detail here, because people start talking about neurons and biocomputing, we start thinking of science fiction and, you know, these sort of weird like alien spaceships where things are fleshy but clever, and I don't think we're quite there. So yeah. So when you say you're using neurons, how does this look? How are you using neurons, and where are these neurons coming from, I suppose, is the next question.
So the neurons are the building blocks also in the brain. Mm. And we have the same neurons, human neurons, in the lab. And this is actually quite standard thing.
Okay.
Because many researchers are using living cells in the lab. So this is actually nothing new. How we get them also is quite standard, already commercialized method, because you can take human skin, and from human skin you can create stem cells, and from these stem cells you can create any cells you want, theoretically any human cells, and also neurons. So this is how we get neurons, and this is actually relatively cheap method to get a lot of neurons in the lab, and that's why actually such a research is possible today, because Without this, I think it would be difficult. So how we do this? So we use the techniques of old field of study, which is electrophysiology. Mm-hmm. You can put living tissue, also living neurons, on electrodes. Mm-hmm. And the neurons, they spike. Mm-hmm. So this exactly what does it mean is that voltage on the membrane of the neuron, every cell has a membrane, and there are things going on this membrane. So the voltage is changing through some process. This is how neurons are processing information. And when they spike, they change the voltage mm-hmm. Rapidly. Mm-hmm. And this is information. It's like a time series of spikes. So yeah. It matters when in time and also where in the space neurons is active. This is information. And also you can use it in the lab. You can put neurons on the electrodes and you can communicate with them in two ways. You can send them electrical signals and you can also measure a response from neuron. So that's the whole idea of this computer, where the input is the signal, electrical, or also chemical, because neurons can also respond to many neurotransmitters, such as, for example, dopamine or serotonin. Mm-hmm. And also we measure the response, like output of the neurons. So the whole idea is that we want to make sense between input and output. So we want to use living neurons to process information in the same way, or let's say similar way, as is used today in silicon computers.
All right. I think there's a lot of places we can go here. So maybe let's. What does this look like? I think of a standard chip in the computer in front of me. I mean, these days there's billions of tiny transistors in there that are also tiny, microscopic yes. almost. Probably a skin cell is almost the same size. But are you packaging these cells into something? Where do these cells go so that you're useful? How do you package them?
So actually, we use a natural process.
Okay.
Which is also used in nature, because when you put neurons close to each other, they naturally form connections. So you don't have to force them. And you can trigger this process in laboratory condition.
Yeah.
You put them in the liquid, shake them all the time. So they're moving and they then form connections. And what we do, there are many ways to use neurons actually in the lab, but what we do, we use organoids. So mm-hmm. these are 3D structures of neurons. Our organoids are around half millimeter diameter, and they consist of around 10,000 neurons each. Mm-hmm. And they are formed in such a natural way. So these are totally random connections. We cannot control this process. We just know it will happen if we put neurons together.
Yeah. Okay.
So we don't know what is inside. It's real black box, of course. And when we communicate with this whole organoid, 3D structure, we only communicate today with the surface. Okay. So we cannot really measure what is inside.
So effectively, if you were to have in a lab a new microchip that you were testing,
yes,
it's effectively the same thing. It's this kind of combination of cells that is connected up to something and you're firing electricity into it.
Yes.
Basically. Okay. And what's the kind of capacity you can reach at the moment in comparison to a modern computer, a modern server, that kind of thing?
So we are really in the development, yep. Let's say, and it's really early stage. Today we can store 1 bit of information, just okay. 1 bit. We call it biobit.
Okay.
So we are very early stage. This is R&D phase. We expect to build the computer in around 10 years. This is very long-term yep. project, of course.
Yep. Yeah.
Very disruptive, very revolutionary, but also it takes time to build.
Okay.
These things cannot happen fast. And it's still a long way until we can really run.
And for that one bio bit, which I'm assuming is equivalent to a normal bit, how many cells do you use?
Well, actually we use the whole organoid, 10,000 cells, but 10,000. Actually, this is a little bit a copy of a digital system, because digital yeah. system, they save bits. So we just did it as an exercise because at this stage, we want to have any results where we can show that we can control the behavior of neurons. That's already very difficult. So actually, for the future computer, you could expect that it's not going to be working for sure, not such a way like logic gates in the computer, because that's how silicon works. In neurons, you have spikes, which are changing in time and space. So actually, this bit, I'm not sure it's really how it will work. But for now, it's a proof of principle that we can control neurons somehow, because that's what we want to achieve, to control them with sending them electrical signals or chemical. But I don't think that we will scale to million of bits on the neurosphere. I don't think it's going to work that way.
Okay. So I think a lot of people, especially listening to this show, you know, reading wherever this may end up, will understand loosely how traditional microchips work. You know, it's just a huge combination of zeros and ones that go much further than that. But that's the fundamental thing. And quantum computing, people sort of vaguely understand, because quantum computing is weird and confusing in that it can be you know, on, off, and every state in between, which doesn't really make sense to a lot of people. So with what you're doing, where does it sit there? Because you talked about different states, space and time, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm assuming that this is not a traditional like 0-1. It's something a little bit more subtle, maybe a bit more akin to quantum computing.
No, I wouldn't say... No, I think quantum is also totally different. So like quantum and silicon and living neurons are totally different. So I don't think it's one interaction of the other. It's just different way, totally different way of computing. And this is why these unconventional methods are so difficult. And actually in quantum computing, you have the same problem that nobody really knows how to program these quantum computers. And this is because it's different than silicon.
So what is the model with this? Like, maybe an easier question to answer would be, this is still an R&D platform, but in the longer run, what are the use cases that you're hoping this platform will excel at?
So actually now we have a platform for R&D, as you're right, which people are already renting. We have already clients who want to try this disruptive approach. But of course, the future we imagined it a different way. The future we imagine as building a huge bioserver.
Okay.
This will be a central computer, something similar like today you have cloud computing. So this will be BioCloud. And we imagine that people will be able to connect this for a cheaper computation. We believe the best use case will be generative AI. Because this is a case where computers are using huge amounts of energy, and we know that brain does this more efficiently for sure, because we know that, for example, analyzing complex problems or generating some text at the end, it costs much less energy for the human because we use living neurons to process information. So we believe in generative AI. Of course, it's at this stage is speculation. We don't, you know, we have to prove it in practice. But that's our assumption. And we imagine that for the end user, it will be no difference. So basically, you will connect to cheaper models. But we would like to make it so that actually the end user doesn't feel it. It's just cheaper. Because that's the real advantage of neurons, that they will, that actually they do cheaper computation. And this problem of AI price is actually maybe not appreciated yet. Because today a lot of AI models are underpriced, which is a normal normal step in the technology development. When there is a phase of adoption, for example, ChatGPT is still very, very cheap. As far as I know, OpenAI lost almost $30 billion
dollars. We're waiting for the bubble to burst, aren't we?
Investors are putting money more and more, and I think they believe, of course, one day will be profitable. But to make it profitable, you have to increase the price, and this after you have good adoption, which you see everywhere in software. After people get used to some solution, the price grows. Yeah. So yes, I think we don't appreciate this problem yet, that AI is very expensive.
Yeah.
And also, if the models are better, then it will be even more money. Yeah. The more we use AI, will also be more expensive.
Yep.
So I think it's a very important advantage in these 10 years when you will be able to provide cheaper computation.
Yeah. Okay. Every time you answer, there's about three directions I want to go. But because I just finished, one of the reasons this your pitch attracted me in the first place, I just finished a book on sustainable computing, just when no one really cares about it anymore. But the power consumption of a lot of servers at the moment is an issue. And you talked about the power efficiency, but there's a concept there of the Jensen's paradox, which is not a new paradox, you know, especially in computing, when people think as things become more efficient, it means you will consume less, but no, you just do more. So actually you don't really save anything. You do 10x instead because you can. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can understand some of the reasons why this would be more energy efficient, mm-hmm. but let's talk about those in a little bit more detail, just to clarify, like, why is it more energy efficient, and what does kind of, you talked about a you know, the equivalent of a cloud computing server data center. Mm-hmm. What would that look like?
So why it's efficient? I wrote recently an article. Okay. So if someone is interested, yep. That I encourage them to check my LinkedIn, and the article is there featured. So there are many differences. So as I mentioned, neurons work totally different than silicon. They process information in time and space. And this is just more efficient, just by principle, how it works. And we know we have quite a lot of literature about this, which is independent from us, of course. Mm-hmm. We did not invent this alone. And many people say that, for example, to reproduce the workings of the human brain, you would need a small nuclear plant.
Jeez, wow. Okay. All right.
And somehow there are many things which brain is doing more efficient. For example, when you think about image analysis, self-driving cars. Of course, it's great that we can use AI in the future for driving, but still brain is analyzing the field of view in much more efficient way. Mm. For example, because of the hierarchical analysis, so we don't treat every information the same way. And also, for example, when the environment is changing, if we talk about image analysis, we analyze only what is changing. While computers analyze over and over all the pixels. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Of course, there are improvements in algorithms, but still computers are using much more. Also, maybe just the nature of zeros and ones is less efficient at the end. And this also is very clear in the generative AI, how huge models you have to build. Of course, they work amazingly. I'm using them a lot, and I appreciate the development of this technology. And it's impressive, but still you see how much energy you have to produce, how many million, billions of parameters you have to build so that you can somehow reproduce this language processing, which is in human brain. Neurons are working differently. Mm. And there are many differences which make them more efficient. So that's one thing. Another thing, how it will look like, you ask me. So we imagine huge bioserver. So this will be huge, actually lab maybe.
Yeah.
And server, which will be built from living neurons.
Okay, yeah.
And we imagine that living neurons, this living neurons processor will be maybe even 100 meters long. Mm-hmm. Very, very big. We want to make it huge. Much bigger than human brain, of course, because we are not restricted by nature. And we want to make it big.
You hope you're not. Who knows? No one's ever made a brain that big. So
this also will be tested in practice. But yes, we want to make these huge structures of neurons, which will process information. And for the end user, you just plug in and use AI the same way as you would use silicon, but you just pay less. Yes.
You know, a conventional server at a data center at the moment needs electricity, cooling, water quite often. What does a bioserver need? Electricity, I think you mentioned, but is there? Do you need to feed it? Do you need to keep it damp? Like, what are the other inputs that you would need?
Yes, damp definitely. So okay. Every living cell has to be actually in water. We are also mainly water.
Yeah, here we are.
So every cell actually to be alive has to be in special liquid, which is called medium in the lab. It's usually pink liquid. And it has all the nutrients, whatever they need, like glucose, vitamins, amino acid, whatever cell is needs for survival. And this liquid is flowing through the cells, similar way as in the body, you have blood, which is flowing through every cell in our body. Mm. So that's why it provides oxygen and nutrients, and it's taking away the waste. Like every cell is kind of like processing machine, is taking some chemicals and giving away other, which is called, this giveaways are metabolites, which is what is released after the consumption. So actually on the cell level, it happens the same. Mm-hmm. And in the bodies, you have blood, but in the lab, if you want to keep living cells alive, you have medium, liquid medium, which plays this role. And of course, you have to change it. So it has to be some kind of flow or exchange of this liquid, so that you have new nutrients and that you can take away old metabolites, so what is discarded from the cell. So yeah, this is what they need. And of course, you also need electricity because we are still, of course, every lab you need today, everything, for everything you need electricity, for the light, for computers, anything. It's still, living neurons are interfaced with digital computers. So, you know, we still use the digital technologies. Yeah. And of course, we send them electrical signals, so we need to use electricity for that. But still, this is not comparable, you know, with how much energy you need.
No.
And cooling also for silicon servers. And also what is different is that the temperature, in every technology, temperature is different.
Mm.
So in digital, you have some optimal temperature, so which is usually quite cold, I think, and you use a lot of water to cool it. In quantum computing, we have extreme low temperature.
Yeah.
And in biocomputing with living neurons, you have 37 degrees Celsius. So this is the temperature of human body. This is physiological. So it's perfect temperature for living human cells, actually any of them, not only neurons. So yes, so this is also different. So I think you then don't have this problem when you have living neurons. You don't have this problem that they produce huge heat, which would have to be somewhere dispensed. So it's different. So I think we could save here not only energy but also water when we talk about biocomputers.
Yeah, and is there something that you predict you could do with that kind of waste fluid, that product of that? Is there a use for that in some way?
I have no idea, honestly. I don't know. I never thought about this. Theoretically, yes, because yes, you can take away substances from cells and even sell them. But that it's a long story, let's say, technically. So not every waste
is
useful.
Not something to worry about quite yet. Yeah.
You can make waste useful, but then it's actually another project. But yes, we could also do this maybe one day.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to go back to some of the really more practical side of things. You mentioned a little bit earlier, and I could see it on the website, about a Python API.
Yes.
So, and you said you would like it to feel like any kind of traditional computing API, but is it like, what is the actual developer experience of using the API at the moment?
Well, you still have to understand some biology. It's necessary to code. And actually, I would say coding in Python is the biggest skill today to work on biocomputing because everything is interfaced with the digital system. So at the end, you use computer and you as a programmer to interface with neurons. So the most important skill is Python, I would say, but it's also important to know some biology. For now, we don't have interface, which doesn't require knowledge in biology. So you need to know, for example, which kind of range of signals you can send to neurons so that you don't kill them, these kind of things. Usually, if you use our lab, you get intro from our engineer who tells you these kind of things. I think it's not so difficult, but maybe for some digital people can be scary because it's still you have to really go into another field. And we are also thinking actually today with the advent of AI, which is so great, also large language models, we use them a lot in many different aspects of our work. And we are also thinking about making interface where you will be telling to AI, because it's completely doable today with the technology, that you will tell to large language model what you want to do as an experiment. A large language model can write you a code script for that. Because today humans write the script, but actually this also can be done by AI.
Yep.
So we are also thinking about such a solutions. Actually, if anyone is listening and has any thoughts about this, I would welcome any opinions, because we are now exploring if this solution would actually help our users.
Yeah.
And maybe it can bring us new users, because for now, everyone who is using Final Spark Neuro Platform, which is our laboratory available remotely for biocomputing, everyone is really coding very well. And some people maybe who are not coding could get scared with this project. But today...
It's the fact that you could kill your computer is is a very different ethical dilemma that most programmers haven't had to face before. So
it's not ethical, it's more practical, because these are just living cells, you know. It's when you scratch your skin, you also...
I know. It's still...
It's just a cell, and actually we have a process to exchange them, because it's a normal biology. Cells are never living forever, unfortunately. They can live even 100 years, as we know.
So you're telling me that your computer could get old?
I don't know if old is... yes, maybe you can say this, because every cell has kind of life cycle. We know they can live up to 100 years, maybe, living neurons, because in our heads they live for our life. Most of them are not dividing, so there are no new neurons. So if we live, they live with us. And we know that it's technically possible from nature, but in the lab it's very difficult. There are different conditions. So for now, we can keep them alive for around 3 months on average. And of course, we want to extend this time, but it's also a lot of engineering work to make it longer. But yes, we have also process to exchange them. And this is normal. When you work with living cells, actually, and any kind of work, you always have to be prepare to exchange them, because there are so many things which can happen in the lab, including contamination or your just mistake, and the cells are very fragile. So yes, it's nothing strange that you sometimes have to change them.
No, I meant to ask this question about 15 minutes ago, but it got too interesting too quickly. We've talked about this sort of fascinating product you're researching here. Like, what was the origin story? Why do this in the first place?
So Final Spark was founded by Fred Jordan and Martin Kutter. These are two Swiss entrepreneurs, and they have PhDs in signal processing, and they are very good in digital signals, digital world. And they had a dream, as many engineers, to build a thinking machine. This is how they started Final Spark. They did some fundamental research in artificial intelligence, and what they realized that it costs a lot of money to build such a machine, which looks like it thinks. And indeed, when you look at the great success of such models like ChatGPT, you can see that it was huge money put in the training, and also execution of this model using it is also very costly. So they realized, the founders of Final Spark, that if they want to make a difference as a small startup, they cannot do what big companies with huge budget are doing, or, you know, big funded projects. They have to be more disruptive. And our first employee, Jean-Marc, he had experience with living cells. He's a physicist by background, but he worked with Professor Markram. He's a famous neuroscientist in Switzerland. And they thought maybe it's a good starting point to try neurons. And this is how they started. And they ventured totally a new field, which is biology, which is still funny, because Final Spark is a bit mixture of biologists and engineers. And engineers are learning biology, and biologists are learning engineering. And this is very, very nice, interesting, stimulating. But yes, they have to go to another field to learn from the scratch new things.
Yeah. Are there many competitors in this space doing something similar, or...?
Not many, but we have competitors. We are very happy with us, that, because this somehow validates the idea that we are not the only one. And our biggest competitor is Cortical Labs from Australia.
Okay. Okay. And I suppose, you know, you talked about a 10-year cycle here, but also that you feel like generative AI could be a use case, but we are yet to see if that is just a bubble. So say in 10 years' time, it isn't something anyone cares about anymore. Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other good use cases that you hope? I mean, it's 10 years. Who knows what it could be? But yeah. But yeah.
Yes, I think difficult to say. I think any kind of computing where the speed is not crucial, where you have complex information, that doesn't have to be LLMs. Of course not.
Yeah.
You have different type of problem solving where a human brain is doing this well and using very little energy. And for sure, we cannot use use cases like for quantum, for example, computing, which is, for example, cryptography, where you have to make a very, very fast computation, repetitive. That's the anti-use case for biocomputing. So there are things where you have some complex information and you have to do this efficiently. That's a good case for biocomputing. And yes, for sure, we will be exploring other options. It's just that generative AI today is a good illustration. And yes, if it's going to be hot in 10 years, then yes, it will be good use case for neurons. That's what we believe.
I mean, it's currently hot. And I mean that in the temperature sense, not the... So
but in 10 years, as you said, you never know.
Yeah, okay. So obviously you have a pretty long runway here of development, but you know, in the short to medium term, what is the roadmap? What do you hope to be releasing and announcing in the next like 6 months to a year?
So at the moment, our next milestone is learning in vitro. So how to actually control the behavior of living neurons. In vitro, so we want to be able to send them signal and receive response, which makes sense. And we want to be able to change connections between neurons because that's learning. Because what is also different between neurons and computer is that neuron is doing learning and processing in the same place. So memory and processing. So basically neurons are learning by changing connections between each other.
Yeah.
So we would like to be able to somehow master this process. That's the next goal.
All right. Absolutely fascinating. I'm assuming if anyone wants to try the API, do they have to talk to you? I'm assuming it's
That's a
little
good
bit,
idea. Yeah. Or you can just check the website, finalspark.com, and send us a message. There are many ways from the website. We have a lot of forms, but it's very easy to get in touch with us. Also, LinkedIn is a good way. Yeah. You can find our email address. It's not difficult. So there are many ways, and we always answer every message. So if anyone is interested in this disruptive research, that yes, definitely will be happy to get connected, yes.
Amazing. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.